it's just over 30 years since the IRA attempted to kill Margaret Thatcher and her cabinet by bombing the Brighton Hotel in which they were staying for the Tory Party conference. The Daily Telegraph called it the most audacious attack on a British government since the gunpowder plot. Here's how it was reported on Today Tonight by Olivia O'Leary and the late Brian Farrell.
Good evening. Today's provisional attack has left at least four people dead, including an MP who is a former deputy chief whip, and more than 20 injured, including a senior British cabinet minister.
The bombing left this morning's Tory conference, to use Mrs. Thatcher's words, shocked and determined. The Prime Minister, who had a lucky escape from the bomb, appeared on the conference platform this morning and received a standing ovation for her declaration that all attempts to destroy democracy by terrorism would fail.
It was an attempt not only to disrupt and terminate our conference, it was an attempt to cripple Her Majesty's democratically elected government. And the fact that we are gathered here now, shocked, but composed and determined, is a sign not only that this attack has failed, but that all attempts to destroy democracy by terrorism will fail.
Well, the Brighton bomb is seen as a turning point in the Troubles, and it was certainly a turning point in the lives of my next two guests, who later became very unlikely friends. Pat McGee is better known as the Brighton bomber, the man who planted the bomb for the IRA and who received 8 life sentences for the crime. He was released under the Good Friday Agreement. Jo Berry is a first cousin of Princess Diana and is the daughter of Sir Anthony Berry, a Tory MP who was murdered by Pat in the Brighton bomb. Pat and Joe, good morning.
Good morning.
You're very welcome. Tell me about your dad, Joe, Sir Anthony Berry, and also your mum, because she has a connection to royalty.
Yes, well, my parents divorced when I was 6. So the first 6 years I remember being in South Wales, and though they were away a lot in London and we had nannies, we were a very close family. Then they divorced and our time was taken with half the time with my dad and half the time with my mum. And I remember the times with my father very special because he wasn't there all the time. My mum was aunt to Princess Diana. So we grew up with her, but after her marriage, you know, I can't say I saw much of her apart from the fact that Diana did come to my dad's funeral in 84.
Your background, meanwhile, Patrick, was very different. Tell me about your background, where you grew up and your family.
I was born in Belfast into a Catholic nationalist family. But at 4, the family moved to England. And I, in fact, spent the next 15 years in England and only returned to Ireland after internment in August 1971.
And was your family a Republican family, Patrick?
I think if you skipped a generation, yes, on both sides. I had a grandfather interned, 2 of his brothers were interned on the Argenta in the 1920s. On the other side of the family, my mother's side of the family, they were also all connected. And I was brought up with stories about both my grannies carrying guns under their shawls. So if you skip a generation, that was a big part of the family history.
And when your parents moved to Norwich, I think you were about 4, did you feel like an outsider when you were there?
I did feel a bit isolated. And in those days, you're talking about the 50s, at school, and it was a Catholic school I went to, I always felt myself to be the outsider there, the Irish kid in the class, even though there was a lot of Irish names in the class, but these would have been people whose families had been established in England and who felt themselves to be English. But I knew I was Irish.
And Joe, your dad obviously was a leading Tory, although not a supporter of Mrs. Thatcher. But were you aware, for instance, of Northern Ireland growing up? Was it something you were ever really aware of as an issue?
I was very aware of it as a teenager. We had bombs going off in London, bomb scares. It was very much part of my life. Obviously not like in Belfast, but in London we certainly had our challenges. And I remember watching the news and constantly seeing the pictures of riots and bombs going off and violence in Northern Ireland. And I especially remember the hunger strike. You know, I wouldn't have supported Mrs. Thatcher's policies at that time. And my dad, he knew that I was never going to vote Tory. And he really accepted that and understood. It wasn't like that I was going to vote for anyone else. I wasn't thinking of politics. And he really gave me his blessing on what I was doing. And I saw that though I had different views with him, he was actually motivated to bring peace. That's how he thought he could do it. So we shared that, and that was a beautiful moment.
And wasn't there a letter you found after he died that you found very touching?
Yes, about 2 or 3 weeks after he died, I received a letter that he sent and then had come back in the most extraordinary way. And I remember opening this letter and I forgot that he was dead when I opened it. You know, there was just a moment of, oh, letter from my dad. And then, oh, you know, this was written obviously before. And it takes time to really, really know the truth that someone, I believe that someone dies, especially in that kind of way. So the letter really touched me. And I remember like every word, sort of reading it and rereading it and keeping it by my bed as a way of getting some healing and support from him.
When and why did you join the IRA, Pat?
Well, I was always interested in politics and in the 60s, I think we all were of that generation. So what was happening in Vietnam, events in Paris of that period. Then suddenly Ireland, Belfast is all over the news. And during that internment week in particular, I was in contact with a phone in the days when there weren't many phones about, but there's a relative up in Andersonstown had a phone. It's probably one of the very few in the district. And got in touch for her, and she was able to tell me about terrible things were happening in the immediate vicinity. The family having to get down behind the settee because they were shooting in the streets and all of that. And so you weren't getting this in the news. I had this real urge to be there and be a witness to it. Not to be part of what was happening, but just to see what was happening. And as soon as I could, I got the old Hesham ferry back to Belfast. Internment was on the 9th. I think I was back in Belfast on the 14th.
Which year are we talking about?
71.
How do you go, though, from being concerned and wanting to be back at home to joining the IRA?
Being a witness to what was happening in the districts, and I ended up living in a place called Unity Flats, and the great spirit of resistance in that area. Then suddenly it's a place under siege. It's a small Catholic enclave at the base of the Shankill Road. There was a British Army Sanger on the corner, constant foot patrols. Lots of activity, women shootings around the area. And I was a witness to how the local people responded to this. And in the end, I wanted to make a contribution. I felt completely with them and wanted to be part of their resistance.
So how did you go about joining, and did you tell your parents?
I didn't tell my parents. In fact, they were quite concerned when they did hear that I was knocking about with certain people, etc. And I think having a conversation with father, who tried to persuade me not to, I would have been about 20 at this stage. It was one of those situations I couldn't not join. You know, it was just a question of what would my contribution be. And so it was a lot of soul searching about that.
You were 20. You were a very young man. But when you were joining up, did it strike you at that age that you might be about to kill people, that joining the IRA meant you would be taking other people's lives?
Well, these were the big questions you had to wrestle with, and you were told to wrestle with. People were saying, like, are you prepared to take lives? And the other big question, would you be able to stand torture, etc.? So you had to do a lot of thinking, great responsibility on your shoulders, to not only to yourself, but to the community and the other people who were with you.
Take me through to the build-up to the Brighton bomb.
There are many aspects of the operation I wouldn't talk about. I can talk in general terms about what I believe to be the long-term strategic thinking behind the bombing, but I couldn't talk about the contacts I had, the conversations we had.
To protect the people you had the conversations with?
Certainly.
So how much in advance of the day of the bomb did you go and prepare to plant it?
I think the bomb was planted some 3 weeks before detonation. So in other words, I had to, it's difficult sitting talking, but I'm sitting beside Joe here. Mm. And obviously that because of the bomb, I killed her father because of that bomb. And so it's difficult sometimes me talking about those events, knowing that Joe's listening. So you had this 3 weeks waiting for that bomb to go off, and that was a very difficult time, obviously. There was a lot rested on that particular operation, and I had the responsibility as the person who planted the device. So, you know, a really trying, testing time for me.
And I know it came out in the court case, so Joe would be aware of it. Anyway, that you booked into the hotel room and stayed there, and I think planted the bomb under the bath. Is that right?
Well, as I said, I wouldn't talk in any specifics about the how we did that operation. And there's still much that is not known.
I would always want to hear more about this. So don't, you know, please don't be reticent because of me, because I would really like to know more. I also understand that you feel you can't. So
I do understand that, Joe, and we can have conversations, private conversations, but there's things I wouldn't be prepared to say openly, and perhaps not even to you.
I know.
Why?
You've already alluded to the fact that people are still capable of being charged over those events.
For the 3 weeks that you planted it with the time device, not to go off for 3 weeks, where were you?
Back in Ireland.
And would you wake up listening to the news every day to see had it gone off prematurely?
There would have been that consciousness, yes. And as the nearer you got to that moment, that increased, of course, until the point where, you know, you knew that detonation was imminent. And that was a tough time. I was actually in a place in Cork out in the country, and I knew when the bomb was due to go off. But at that stage, there was no live broadcasts, and I think there was some radio station off the Irish coast that was pumping, earlier news on the hour. And I didn't actually hear that the bomb had gone off until about 6 o'clock next morning. So it was a long night. And obviously, you couldn't rely on people phoning you. There would have been a complete clampdown in any communications.
How did you feel when you heard it had gone off?
The overwhelming feeling I thought at that precise moment of hearing the news that the bomb had actually detonated was one of relief. That just at my part in the operation, I'd been successful, I can use that term. And there was a great responsibility on my shoulders. It had gone off. I think then the enormity of what had happened began to encroach during the next hours and days and weeks.
Meanwhile, Joe, at what stage did you realise, A, your dad was there, and B, there had been a bomb?
Well, I was in London staying with my twin sister, and I think she woke me up at 6:30 to say a bomb had gone off at the Grand Hotel. So I knew very early on. And then we probably got the news about 2 or 3 in the afternoon that our stepmother was injured and that our dad was dead. And all that time we were waiting and hoping and trying to get in touch with people. And my brother was living in Brighton, giving us messages. It was a very long wait.
Who told you your father was dead?
My brother. He'd been given a signet ring that they found on my dad's body, and my brother's got the same signet ring, and that's how they had the proof it was him. And my brother rang, and he suggested that we went straight to pick up our half-brother and half-sister from their schools. And I remember I had to leave the flat, and I walked around in Notting Hill Gate trying to get the thought into me that he was dead. And I remember moving my arm up and down going, "Dad's dead, Dad's dead." And then there were a couple of guys on a building site, and they shouted down, "Come on, give us a smile, it can't be that bad." And I looked up at them and said, "It is, my dad's been killed." And carried on. I mean, I was just unaware of my circumstances. And then getting back to my sister's, and we got in the car and drove off. And I'll never forget, you know, the moment of telling them. They were 13 and 15, the news about their dad. And then we drove them to their aunt's house in London.
At that stage, were you just dealing with your incredible emotional distress, or did you feel any anger at that stage at the people who had bombed the hotel?
I felt no anger. I was definitely feeling shock and loss and pain. But actually, I remember on the Sunday, so 2 days later, going to St James's Church in London, which was a place that meant something to me, And I wasn't going there as a Christian. I was going there as someone who believed in a spiritual life, and sitting in the church and saying, I am going to find a way to bring something positive out of this. And I am going to try and understand those who've killed my father. And so very early on, and I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know how to bring something positive, but a journey started.
Do you remember much else in the weeks and days after your father's death? Did you go and see a counsellor? Did you speak to people about how you were feeling?
Looking back, it seems very odd that we were offered no counselling and no one was interested in what I was feeling. I felt very on my own. People said to me, well, they would just start talking about their own dads, you know, or they would start talking about something completely irrelevant. So I didn't really find that emotional support. It was a long time.
At that time, Pat, when you saw the people, I suppose, being carried out on stretchers of the Grand Hotel and Margaret Tebbit, never mind Joe's dad being dead, did you feel any guilt at that stage that you had taken their lives or done this to them?
I think no. I don't think I felt that at all. I saw them as, to be perfectly honest, a completely dehumanised view of the people we were fighting against. I saw them Tories and all culpable for what was happening in our streets, the oppression in Ireland, the most guilty, the people of all the resources who had resorted to violence in the first instance, and we were targeting them. I think it was a later realisation about, in a sense, how blinkered, how reduced a view I specifically had developed in the course of that struggle.
You eventually were picked up and charged with that bombing. Can you remember where you were?
I was arrested some 8 or 9 months after the Brighton bomb. I was on another operation which involved more bombs in England. And so I was caught in the middle of a campaign in England, in Scotland.
And were you surprised to be picked up?
Well, you did your best not to be. You were careful what you were doing. But somebody connected with us had been followed over from Ireland, and the surveillance picked up on me, and we unfortunately led them back to the team, and we were all scooped.
Did you realise at that moment when you were picked up that you were very likely to spend the rest of your life in prison?
I'd have known that for years before then. That was always on the cards. I had already successfully defended against an extradition warrant for bombs in England. And I'd been on the run out of the north for a long time. So it was inevitable if I was arrested, I was going away for a long time. And I ended up with a 50-year tariff.
When did you realise that you might get released under the Good Friday Agreement?
We were transferred back from England, that is Irish Republican prisoners were transferred back from England to jails in Ireland the day after the first ceasefire was called, and I think it was the 31st of August 1994. In fact, the day after, I was back in jail in McGabbery Prison in the north. And so we knew things were moving ahead. We had this sense that things were in our favour, that it would take a few years, but behind the scenes, the politics would be going on, the negotiations which would eventually lead to our release. An important part of the whole negotiations would be, you know, the release of the prisoners.
Did you know of Patrick McGee's name, Joe? I mean, did that stay strong in your brain after he was convicted for the bombing?
Yes, I didn't go to any of the court cases. I felt quite detached from it all at that time. And then I remember in 99, turning on the TV and seeing Patrick being released from prison. And my first thought was, oh, it's all right for him, he's free, but my dad can never come back, and feeling quite angry. And then thinking, well, this is for peace, so less people are going to be killed now. Therefore, you know, I welcome the peace process. And I also thought, maybe I'll be able to meet him now he's out of prison.
And had you thought about meeting him before that?
Yes, in 86. I thought if the time was right, if I was ready, it's something that I would welcome. So it was always there as a possibility. And during the year 2000, I met many people who knew Patrick And they said, oh, we'll organise it, you know, we'll make sure it happens. And then one day, a very, very dear friend of mine, Anne Gallagher, who had Seeds of Hope, Fantastic Peace Project, sadly, she died 2 years ago. It was a great loss. But she rang me up to say, I've arranged for Patrick to be in my house this evening. Can you be there? And I was so shocked. And I remember my first thought was, I'm not in the mood. I'm not feeling visionary. I'm not feeling inspired. I'm feeling quite mundane, leaving my young daughters at home. But then I did go, and I got on the ferry between Holyhead and Dublin. I was living in North Wales. Quite terrified.
So when you got out, Pat, and you heard that Joe Berry wanted to see you, what was your initial reaction?
Well, I'll preface that by saying that even before we were released, we were doing some mental preparation for the moment and thinking, what contribution could you make to the peace process? And we knew that there were a lot of issues, a lot what are termed these days legacy issues that we're dealing with the past, a big one of which would have been the victims. But I'd also thought I could see me sitting around the table and talking to erstwhile enemies, former enemies, RUC people, loyalists, British Army squaddies, etc.
But what about the daughter of a man you had murdered?
I think that did surprise me, that somebody directly connected with Braden. Again, it's because I think we were acting this reduced view of the other. We saw these as our implacable enemies, the Tories. We would never, we never thought for a second that they would show any sort of inclination to meet with us and talk about the past. So that did come as a surprise.
But in the end, you agreed.
I think I readily enough agreed. I asked the people who had met Joe, and Joe had met several people I would have known, and I would ask them, what did Joe, I wouldn't have known her as Joe then, what did she hope to achieve from meeting me? And she wants to understand, that's all. And I thought, well, I can understand that. I wanted just to be reassured that it wasn't going to be a confrontational meeting, which I wouldn't have agreed to. That it was about me going there, hopefully with some sensitivity, to explain our motivations. And it would be a one-off meeting, after which that would have been it.
And yet she would have been perfectly entitled to be confrontational, wouldn't she?
Mm-hmm. And I got none of that. I got absolutely the opposite of confrontation. What I got was somebody who keenly listened to what I was saying, me putting my perspective. And in a sense, I found that very disarming, especially against the backdrop of being in a movement that for years had been demonised, dehumanised and misrepresented. And here suddenly I'm in the face of somebody, and I've killed her father, and she's given me more attention and, in a sense, credence than I'd ever, up to that point, experienced.
Can you remember, both of you, the first words you exchanged at the first meeting?
I do remember standing at Anne Gallagher's door, and it suddenly hitting home the enormity of what I was about to do, to go through that door and meet somebody whose father I killed. So when I walked in and met Joe, it was a very scary moment. It was definitely a scary moment. But Joe very quickly, I think, took some of the sting out of it, the right way of phrasing it, by her openness. You know, I didn't get any sense of fear of this possible confrontation at all. Somebody who was there just to listen for what I had to say. And as I said, we talked for 3 hours. That's the incredible thing.
But I was so curious. I remember looking at you, Pat, and thinking, you planted a bomb that killed my dad, but who are you? Who are you other than that? And just really curious as to how you were in your normal life. And so I think that's why it carried on for so long, because I wanted to know. And certainly I got more than I bargained for at that first meeting. You know, I really did. It started off with Pat justifying to me, and he did do it with some sensitivity, but he was coming with a political justification. And I knew that was going to happen. I'd met other men who'd been in the IRA, and I was quite sure I was going to get that. And I was ready for it. And what I wanted was to see the man behind the label. I want to see him as a human being. And so I kept on asking questions and listening and sharing about my father. And I remember thinking, I can see that he's got sensitivity. I can see him as a human being. So I've actually got what I want, but I won't come back for a second visit because he is saying that it was a strategy that worked. And I do find that hard. And then just as I thought that, there was a silence, and Pat then stopped justifying and said to me, I want to be able to hear your pain and your anger, and what can I do to help? And the conversation was really different after that. I was much more personal and open, and I realised that we'd started a journey together, and what I thought was going to be a one-off was going to be something that would grow. I had no idea that we'd still be meeting and working together all these years, but I knew there was going to be a second meeting. And what I think happened was that it was the beginning of Pat seeing my dad as a human being. And I remember at the end of 3 hours, it was so intense, and I had different parts of me thinking different things and saying, and I couldn't sustain it anymore. And I knew I had to go, so I thanked Pat, and he said, I'm really sorry I killed your father. And it was said with a lot of feeling.
Do you recall that meeting the same way, Pat?
There's much of that day I'll never forget. It was such an intense, profound experience. As I said, I went along there. I described it at the time as wearing a political hat, this political obligation to explain. But then, in the presence of somebody you've really hurt, and that person listening to me, talking about her father, sharing things about growing up, I suddenly began to get this impression of this guy I'd killed, whereas before none had existed. He was just this cipher, the Tory, the enemy. Suddenly, I'm making this connection between a person who, over a couple of meetings, I gained a great liking for, and I'm seeing this is a very smart, good woman. A lot of the goodness I perceive in her must have come from her father, and I killed this guy. And it suddenly became a really profound measure of the loss, a loss that I had not up to that moment appreciated.
Did you go in wanting or expecting him to apologise for killing your father?
Nope, and I didn't even need that. Because I'd heard from other men who'd been in the IRA that he would have come with a feeling of righteousness about it and that he wasn't going to apologise, and that was fine. I actually had someone apologise to me in 86, someone from Sinn Féin here in Dublin. But I wasn't going for that. I thought if I have that, that would be fantastic. That's not what it was about, no.
When you were going in the door of the house of your friends, did you think you might say sorry to her?
No, there was no anticipation of that development. It's very surprisingly difficult to put myself back entirely in that moment and what I was going through. I'm kind of lost for words about it now. I find myself actually surprised, and you might be amazed to hear this, that I'm finding this difficult now sharing that moment, our moment, that first meeting here, because you're right back at that moment, and so there's kind of, you're flooded by some of the emotion of that time, and I'm feeling it right at this moment.
Could you share more what you're feeling?
I do remember an overwhelming sense right at the tail end that this was a conversation that had to continue.
Mm-hmm.
There was that. So I went, but I wasn't expecting to hear from you. I thought, well, that's more could have been said. This was important. I had been unprepared for the emotions that were stirred up in that first meeting. And so there was a really overwhelming, even I would say need to talk further, but I didn't to any degree expect any other contact. So when I heard from Joe that she wanted another meeting, I was grateful for that opportunity, to continue that conversation.
Did it alter your view of what groups like the IRA do?
I think it's important. It's actually an obligation for anybody who comes through struggle to appraise that struggle, reappraise it, keep going back to it and asking difficult questions of ourselves. And I think, because I would never, for one second, although I believe that we were justified in our struggle, I would never attempt to justify all aspects of it. But I think the bottom line is we had to do what we had to do. But it is important to go back and go over all of it and ask the difficult questions, such as, were there other options open to us at the time?
And were there?
I'm still asking that question. I think there are certainly things that could be done differently from all sides, not only the Republican movement. They weren't operating in a vacuum.
Because I suppose there are other people, the John Humes of the world, who opted for the different path, who didn't sign up despite growing up in an unfair and unequal dairy. So there are other choices.
Mm-hmm. I would say that there are not many choices evident if you were living in Unity Flats in 1971, 1972.
You also said there you wouldn't ever justify all of the struggle. What elements of it would you justify?
Once we had properly targeted where the real culpability lay for what was happening, shaped our campaign accordingly, I think that's justifiable. And I am talking about targeting government people. I do have a lot of regrets. I think we all do. The way at times I think the campaign descended into sectarianism. I think that's deeply, deeply regrettable. Not now, it was regrettable then, and it was appreciated how wrong it was then. But again, these were very chaotic times.
Because at the end of the day, I suppose, what right do you have to take someone else's life?
I wish that the focus of the media and journalism were more focused on those who had the power and therefore the options and the resources, but who, in the first instance, resorted to violence, rather than focus on those who felt they had no other options but to defend their areas.
Joe, when you met Pat, did you feel at all you were letting the memory of your father down by meeting the man who had killed him?
After that first meeting, I left being quite euphoric, but then descended into a very low time. And yes, I did feel betrayal. I did have regrets. It was a very private thing I did. I mean, no one knew. My family didn't know. I never, ever meant it to go public.
And in terms of your siblings, all of your brothers and sisters, did they mind you meeting Pat?
Well, they wouldn't have known until 2001, and they gave me their support. And sometimes it has been hard for them. I just want to acknowledge their strength and their humanity and the fact that we're all still very close. Despite the fact it must be difficult at times.
Is it an overwhelming feeling of guilt, Pat, and that by her forgiving you, it assuages that guilt?
There's a circle that nearly you can't square. It's the fact that you could stand over their actions, but you carry this burden, this guilt, that you hurt human beings. And I think that's what you're trying to exorcise in perhaps meeting, you know. I don't think you can square that circle.
Does that feeling of guilt not squaring the circle, does it get worse as you get older?
I think the best I can hope for from talking about it, delving back into the past, is to somehow be less conflicted about, you know, the gulf between being able to stand over your actions and carrying a real sense of loss, you know, because not only the loss of a life taken, something you've lost in yourself, been involved in that struggle and making those decisions. I think because, it was a realisation that came from talking to Joe and this growing appreciation of who her father was, you know, that had this very reduced view of the people you were in conflict with. And you can only have a reduced view like that at some expense to your own, I think, humanity.
Do you regret killing Joe's father?
Yes.
I'm remembering when my middle daughter, who was 7, she had lots of questions for Pat, and one of them was, Pat, when you planted that bomb in the Grand Hotel, did you not see that my granddad Tony was there? And you saying, Pat, no, please tell her that I didn't see any human beings there. And that to me sums up what this is about. You know, my last words to Pat at the first meeting was, I'm so glad it's you, which is a really odd thing to say. I don't think Pat knew what I meant. But you know what? I stand by those words because I recognise his preparedness to go into the emotions, the difficult emotions of this.
And on that issue of forgiveness, Pat, I was listening not that long ago, a few months back, to Norman Tebbit, and he was saying he couldn't forgive you for what happened to him and his wife, but that the reason he couldn't forgive you was because he felt you hadn't repented. Mm. Would you like to respond to that? Do you feel you have repented?
I think Norman Tebbit's coming from a very specific understanding of forgiveness, and it's a religious understanding that I can't relate to, and even the term repentance, I don't understand it.
Is it that what he's looking for? I mean, if Norman and Margaret Tebbit were here, and obviously she was paralysed, it changed their lives forever. Is it that he wants you, his idea of repentance, is that you say how incredibly sorry you are and you wish you'd never done it? I mean, I know it can be interpreted different ways, but if you were confronted by them, what would you say to them?
Well, it's not only about confronted by them, it's confronted by anybody who's been hurt in that conflict, and all sides have been hurt. Yeah, again, there's this obligation to look back and ask yourself the difficult questions about, was there another course open to us? So I do carry a heavy burden there. I do regret the loss of life and all those injured. And how could you not regret somebody spending the rest of their life in a wheelchair because of your actions? So of course that applies.
The organisation you're both involved in, Building Bridges for Peace, mm-hmm. Tell me about it.
Well, I founded the charity in order to learn from this experience and build peace in the world. And it's very much about understanding violence and making sure there are options open to people. So we just had the 30th anniversary of the Brighton bomb, and we're focusing very much on young people because I see that many young people are being demonised at the moment and in England. So that's a focus at the moment. I'm involved in many Muslim groups, and they're being demonised in a way which I think is similar to how the Irish used to be demonised. And it's about learning to understand and listen and give other options. I think even, you know, the young men and women who've gone to Syria, you know, there's a way of finding ways to understand and bring them back so they can be the ones who tell the young people what it's really like out there and stop them travelling the same route.
Well, look, Pat McGee, Joe Berry, I really appreciate you both coming in this morning to talk to me. And your organisation is buildingbridgesforpeace.org. And yes. I wish you both the very, very best for the future.
Thank you, Maureen.
Thank you very much.
Lots and lots of reaction to that interview with Joe and Pat. I'll bring you some of it. Tom and Galway says Joe's forgiveness is just amazing, as is Pat's honesty. Michael and Ney says Joe is a thoughtful and intelligent lady, but I feel she's being exploited by McGee for his own and his organisation's reasons. I don't detect any real sense of contrition, only self-justification. Joe unwittingly called his bluff by asking him to elaborate on the bombing, and the Republican barrier came up. He closed ranks in order to protect the movement. Niall Allen says it's really powerful listening to Pat McGee, the Brighton bomber, and Jo Berry, the daughter of Tory MP killed in the bombing. Mary in Tipperary says, Miriam, I was in Brighton on the day of the bombing of the Grand Hotel and killing and maiming of innocent people. I was ashamed to be Irish in Brighton on that awful day. Murder is murder in anyone's language. John Hedges says, those still fighting the war, especially political leaders, should listen back to Pat McGee and Joe Berry. David from Cork says, Miriam, I listen to your programme regularly, but you should not be interviewing a person that killed so many people in that hotel. Brendan Wexford, Miriam, your interviewees are brave and honest. I don't agree with violence, but I have never had to think of using it. We have a lot to learn to better understand radicalism and to halt it in Ireland, Europe and globally. I'll bring you one more. Francis, the Brighton bomber is still making excuses 30 years later. Who is he trying to convince, us or himself? for what he justified. He did not do it for me. These people died and suffered for nothing. I'll bring you one last one. Conor Reedy, that was a thoroughly extraordinary discussion with the Brighton bomber and the daughter of one of his victims. And one more, fascinating to hear from the Brighton bomber, Pat McGee, and his victim's daughter, Jo Berry.